So hello and welcome to CCCB, to our Datengarten number 74. Today we will hear about Bitcoin, but not so much about the technical details, where we already had a talk. You can find it on media.ccc.de, but about how it can be used for activists and for the resistance. Yes, if you have questions during the talk, please hold on to them until the end. Just raise your hand. I will give you this microphone then, so your question will be on the stream and on the recording, so everybody knows then what the answer is about, because it's really annoying if it's not this way later on the recording. So, yeah, without further ado, I'm really happy to announce Matt Corallo here, who will give us, I hope, an amazing talk. So greet him with a warm hand of applause.
Cool, thanks. So talking about Bitcoin, great. I have been working on Bitcoin since 2011. I do work on all of the wonderful technical aspects at the very low protocol level, so you're welcome to ask any kinds of crazy technical questions you want at the end. But I figured it would be more interesting to give a talk on why Bitcoin is cool. And so I'm really going to focus on kind of why other people are interested in Bitcoin, what the general philosophy that I think kind of brings Bitcoiners together is, and then kind of more personally, why I work on Bitcoin and why I'm really excited about Bitcoin and why I think it's cool. So what is Bitcoin at a social level, not a technical level? And I'm not talking about blockchain or private blockchain or any of these kinds of things. I'm talking exactly about Bitcoin. And so maybe a bit of history is helpful here. Bitcoin is not the first eCash system. eCash has been a marker of various groups trying to build really awesome private monies or anonymous monies or whatever for many years, since the 90s at least, somewhat before. And all of those systems failed. Every single one. There were a number of attempts, but all of them kind of failed to live up to the ideals that they started with. Some of them failed because they had some business that had to exist that went out of business just because it wasn't run well. Some of them failed because the government decided that you can't issue a private and anonymous digital money because that would be bad. And so they went out of business for that reason, because the government came down on them. But all of them at some point failed because there was some business that could go under or get shut down or whatever, because it was this centralized point that the entire system had to trust. And often they didn't have to trust it with their privacy, there was great crypto, whatever, but they still had to trust it to exist and continue to function. And Bitcoin was really a response to that. Bitcoin really grew out of this movement and grew into this idea that you shouldn't be trusting anyone, and you should try to design a system that completely gets rid of all trust. And so I think everyone, or I hope everyone, saw the Datengarten, I think, two ago, where the kind of technical overarching design was explained, where you have transactions, and you put them in a block, and you have miners that solve a hash puzzle, and then they create blocks. But what that really didn't talk about, and what was really missed there, was what the trust model was, and who's validating what. And so it's important to point out that every node is validating everything. So when you create a transaction in Bitcoin, you're not trusting the miners to validate that that person who sent you the money had the money, or that it was a valid signature, or that there was a valid whatever. You're only trusting them for double spends. And so this was kind of the solution that Satoshi came up with to remove centralized third-party trust, was to introduce the idea of miners, but only for double spends. And everything else, you don't have to trust anyone to use Bitcoin. So you know, this isn't quite the goal of this magic trustlessness system where you don't have to trust anyone, but it's super close. And the way people use Bitcoin today, it's really not all that trustless. You know, people wait for 6 confirmations, they wait for 3 blocks, 1 block, or no blocks. You can buy matzah at the bar without getting any confirmations and double spend pretty easily. But so, I mean, there's some trust involved there, but that's fine. You can also choose to use Bitcoin and wait for a week of blocks or a month of blocks to accept a payment. And for a very large payment, you might wait a day. And when you start looking at timescales like this, all of a sudden this idea that, oh, you're trusting 51% of hash power and they might decide to undo the blocks and rewrite the chain starts to make a whole lot less sense. And all of a sudden you start to put very clear monetary figures on it. You start to say, well, it's going to cost them this much money, this many euros, this many dollars to undo that, and there's going to be a massive opportunity cost. And if you start talking about time frames of a month, well, the other half of the brilliance of mining power in Bitcoin is that you can go buy hash power. And there's a lot of people who are in positions to be able to go spend $1 million and buy hash power at a very large scale to keep the system running if there is a large attack by miners who have existing hash power, or if they try to rewrite 6 months worth of chain history. And so all of a sudden, this trustlessness starts to make a whole lot more sense when you start to talk about these large time frames. But again, most users don't use that kind of full security model of Bitcoin. Instead, they opt to relax certain trust models. And so I think at the end of the day, a lot of the interesting use cases for Bitcoin come from some part of deciding not to trust someone. And Bitcoin is designed so that you don't have to trust anyone, but at the end of the day, there's always people we're willing to trust. If you're using Euro, you're willing to trust the ECB. And frankly, I think the ECB does a pretty good job. I'm perfectly happy trusting the ECB. I'm less happy trusting the Venezuelan Bolivar, which is currently worth shit. Some people aren't willing to trust banks. Some people aren't willing to trust other groups. And so I think Bitcoin comes back to kind of the central reason of trustlessness and builds a bunch of different things on top of that. So, you know, as I mentioned, there's a bunch of different use cases. Maybe I live in New York, I talk to a bunch of traders and hedge fund folks, and a lot of these folks are really excited about Bitcoin. Not because they care about not trusting banks, for fuck's sake, they work for banks, they like banks, but because they like to hedge their bets, and they like to hedge everything, and Bitcoin makes for a great hedge against fiat. Somewhat similarly to gold, but it turns out Bitcoin is a great hedge against the Bolivar going to zero, or if the USD or the yuan or something goes down, Bitcoin can be argued to be a pretty good hedge there because you have this 21 million coins limit. And you don't have to trust anyone to enforce the 21 million coins limit. You, the software that you are running, is enforcing the 21 million coins limit every second of every day, and every transaction, you validate that it meets the 21 million coins limit. And so if you want a deflationary system that has a limit and you want to hedge the US dollar or the Venezuelan Bolivar blowing up, Bitcoin makes a lot of sense. Similarly, you might want to transact without a counterparty in a lot of places. Modern banks, the way they function and kind of the thing they provide for society is they act as trust anchors. They act as someone who we agree to trust in order to be able to transact with each other. When I send an Überweisung, I'm agreeing to trust, we're both agreeing that when the bank says that I've received money from you, I actually received money from you. And when the bank says that I've sent money to you, I've actually sent money to you. And this makes a whole lot of things really efficient. Obviously, our entire economy is built around this kind of trust. And in a lot of places, that's great. And some other places, that makes less sense. Again, this is something that makes a whole lot less sense in parts of the world where the banking industry is maybe not as trustworthy. But equivalently, I know a lot of people in New York who remember very vividly 2008 and going to bed at night and thinking, fuck, my bank might not be there tomorrow. And if they're not, I'm insured for $250,000 and that's it. Or maybe your Deutsche Bank a few months ago where people were worried about the stability of Deutsche Bank, but that was less likely. And so, you know, it's just another example of a counterparty you might not want to trust, and Bitcoin gives you the option to not trust anyone. Similarly, a lot of people like to talk about how Bitcoin is this global currency that doesn't have borders. And again, this comes back to not having to trust anyone. Now, of course, you could construct a digital e-cash that has a central counterparty that ignores borders, but at the end of the day, you are still going to trust that entity in that country. And so if you're in another country and you don't want to abide by the laws of, let's say, the United States, and you don't want Donald Trump to take your money, then maybe you don't want to trust some counterparty in the United States. Similarly, if you're in Somalia and there is no good remittance service because Western Union decided that they're not going to serve Somalia anymore and they were the only one left, then maybe all of a sudden this idea that you don't have to trust a bank to provide you service or you don't have to trust someone makes a whole lot more sense, because you can accept Bitcoin, you can use Bitcoin without having to opt into some trust relationship that someone doesn't want to provide you because of, well, Somalia. Or lastly, you know, maybe you're an American and you want to buy a Congress pass without paying a 30% fee on credit cards. Just a hint, take Bitcoin. Thank you. I would appreciate it. But really, you know, all that's great, and I love all those things about Bitcoin, but what I really want to talk about is access to the financial system. So financial censorship, right? It really is critical every day that you be able to access your money in order to do anything. For example, at 32C3, I think, I was chatting, or maybe it was 31, the Cage guys, who gave a great talk. They're based in London. They do great work for activists who, in favor of people who have been detained falsely at Guantanamo or at CIA black sites. They've done a lot of research into finding these people and advocating on their behalf and getting them out of this crazy internment that they've been placed in. But they can't get a bank account because the government has said, what you're doing, we don't like it. You're doing research into the black sites, and that's not acceptable. And so you can't have a bank account. And this means that they can't accept donations online. You know, a lot of people at Congress were asking them, you know, how can I donate to you? I think your work's great. How can I give you money? And their response was, give us pound cash. We can't take donations online in any way because we just can't get bank accounts. And, you know, ultimately this happens to a lot of organizations. And a number of individuals, a lot of it is very legitimate. Obviously, we don't want terrorists to have bank accounts, but a lot of it is just people who are unable to do their work because someone decided that what they're doing is not okay. This is especially a problem after 9/11. So I've got a great quote here that I'm going to read from someone who was in the US Treasury Department right after 9/11, you know, at that time, and was a leader being tasked with stopping terrorist financing. So it was his job to make sure that terrorists couldn't get money. And so what he said in a book about kind of the decisions they were making at that time was, they set it up such that governments did not have to demonstrate that designated individuals or entities actually intended to support terrorism or even knew their money or activities were being used to support terrorism to preventatively freeze their assets. Further, they needed to have 80% surety that their targets were legitimate in order to take people's money. And they can reach across borders and do this. When the US Treasury puts you on a list, and this is the US Treasury, not a court, this is a group of individuals who have largely no oversight, have had great power to reach into the EU and freeze people's bank accounts, have had great power to reach into anywhere in the world to take bank accounts. And this has become, initially, it was just a US regulation and Europe and a few other places, but eventually they added this and made it a UN standard for banking regulations, that countries should be able to do this without too much oversight. And certainly that's not a bad thing if it's used for good reason. Maybe the 80% surety level is questionable, but if it's used for good reason, that's not bad. But it turns out that it isn't just used for good reason. So there are cases where The US government reached into Europe and froze people's assets, and these individuals then had to file lawsuits in Europe to get their money back, and they won. But that's not a cheap process, that's super expensive, and the courts in Europe said, like, what the hell? But this is still something that happens every day to people everywhere in the world. Further, you know, I mean, it's one thing for the government to take actions which you can challenge in court. It's a whole other thing, you know, financial institutions don't have to give you a bank account. If you walk into a bank, they can just say no, and there's no legal requirement, in most countries at least, that you have access to a bank account. And the way that banks normally say no, they make these decisions based on lists that they've spent millions of dollars to curate from various government sources and various of their own research. And so we have many cases, especially in the US, but also, I mean, with the Cage guys, they were in London and similar things happened, where someone, whether it's a financial regulator or someone in a position, comes to a bank and says, look, these guys, they do this stuff where they're like researching Guantanamo Bay and they're researching, you know, how to get people out of these places. They're high risk. They might get sued or something, and then your bank is going to look bad. And as a result, they can't get an account. Right, because if you're a bank, it is your job to police your customers to make sure that they're not doing something illicit. And if it turns out that your customers were doing something illicit, it looks very bad for you, as it should. But as a result of this, there's this kind of chilling effect where a government agency can just kind of hint, wink, wink, and say, you probably don't want to do business with this, and all of a sudden, they won't. And so, you know, while there's a legitimate reason for a lot of this, the question is this too far and do we need some kind of protections around this? And sadly, the way the whole system is set up, it's very hard to get any kind of additional protections there. You know, obviously there's the incentives for government officials are just not in line with privacy for obvious reasons, right? If there's a terrorist attack, we're all going to be really pissed off and we're going to say, like, what did you do to stop this? And why didn't you do more? And so we look at, especially in the US, but also in France and the UK and many other countries, government officials, the incentives for them are to do as much as they possibly can, privacy and financial freedoms be damned, to make sure that these things don't happen to most people. And, you know, you make sure that your regulations and your restrictions don't apply to most people, and it's a pretty small group, but there's still a question as to whether or not that's an acceptable outcome. Luckily, Bitcoin helps. Bitcoin helps a lot here. So, you know, I talked to the Cage guys at Congress and said, like, look, you can take Bitcoin, and you can find people in London who will gladly buy your Bitcoin. You're not doing anything illegal. The government has watched you incredibly closely, and if you were doing something illegal, there's no question you'd be in jail right now. And you can take Bitcoin, you can accept donations online, you can turn it into pounds, and you can get more funding to do the great work that you guys are doing. So, you know, Bitcoin isn't still, it doesn't like solve these problems. It's not like, oh, governments can never take your Bitcoin, governments can't regulate Bitcoin. No, Bitcoin, there's still plenty of ways that you could take someone's Bitcoin. You could actually go steal their computers because it's all on your computer. You could, of course, there's heavy regulation in Bitcoin at the on and off ramps at the exchanges. And there's no question that any of the financial blacklists that exist in the current financial space, where if you go and you do a bunch of business with Iran, you are in trouble, not the person you did business with in Iran, those of course all apply to Bitcoin. So it's not that Bitcoin somehow magically gets rid of regulation, because we have regulation for a reason, but it increases the cost of governments to take these actions where they can seize people's money or prevent them from gaining access to their money or prevent them from having access to financial services at all. Just like SSL certificate transparency doesn't prevent the NSA from issuing fake certificates, but it provides a social cost to that. The second they go and issue a fake certificate, we all see it, and we all show up at their door and we say, like, what the hell are you doing? Is this acceptable? What was the reasons for this? And then we can have a discussion socially as a society about whether or not this was an acceptable action. And so my you know, personally, why I work on Bitcoin is to create a similar thing in the finance space. You can put people on public lists of sanctions, and you can break into people's houses with a court order or warrant and take their computers and take their Bitcoin. You can go into their safety deposit boxes with a court order and take their Bitcoin. But then we actually have a clear and distinct action by the government that we can either fight in court if it was unjust, or we can have a discussion socially about whether that was an okay action. Further, financial privacy, right? So losing access to your money is one thing, but what about the privacy of all of the things you do with your money? You know, we all care a lot at CCC and Congress, and all of us folks care a lot about the privacy that we have online. You know, we don't want governments to know everything we do on the internet, because why should they have that information? Also, everyone we call, everyone we talk to, why should governments have all of that information available with little oversight over the people watching it? Well, similarly, why should governments have all of the information over all the transactions you're doing with little oversight on their ability to go and find that information, on the ability of individuals within the government to go and find that information? And the way financial privacy has moved over the last 10, 20 years, it's gone very much in that direction, very much in the same direction that we've seen the internet and phone calls and SMS go. We've seen the same thing happen for financial privacy. Unlike in the internet, where everyone talks about it being an anti-terrorist thing, in financial world, a lot of it is related to tax evasion. A lot of it is related to making sure that countries share information between each other about who has accounts where, so that if someone is evading taxes, we can find them and we can prosecute them. That said, of course, a lot of it is also about terrorist financing. And there's a lot of stuff that happened after 9/11, where governments have been able to much more easily get information from banks. And in fact, even similar to what I was talking about earlier, it's up to banks to police their own users, and it's up to banks to provide information to the government when they think it's appropriate. Well, if you're providing information to the government when you think it's appropriate, and your reputation is at risk if you ever forget to provide something that turned out to be appropriate, what do you do? You provide them everything, because there's no cost to you providing them everything. In fact, there's explicit laws in the US and other places that make it so that you can't be prosecuted if you gave too much information to the government. And so, as a result, we see this especially with Bitcoin exchanges, but also with banks. Largely, all of the information is provided to treasuries of transactions over a certain value and transactions which look like they might be smaller pieces of a larger transaction, all kinds of things. But what does Bitcoin do here? Well, stopping tax evasion, we can do that with Bitcoin. We can have requirements that you prove that all of your money paid taxes without giving up any of your privacy. We have technology to do these kinds of things. We have ZK SNARKs, which is, for those of you who aren't familiar, you should go look it up. But it's magic, almost magic crypto that, while it's still very new and has big assumptions about the ability to forge proofs, it allows you to create a proof that says, look, here's this program that you told me to run on some inputs, and I'm not going to tell you the inputs, but I'm going to give you a proof that says that I ran that program faithfully, and here's the output. But I don't have to tell you the inputs, and you don't have any ability to learn anything about the inputs. And so we could envision applying this to Bitcoin, right? We have this transaction history that we can keep, and we can say, like, look, here's my transaction history had income of this amount, and I paid taxes, and you run the program. They don't learn anything about your transaction history, but at the end it says, I owed $100,000 in taxes, and guess what I paid the tax authorities? $100,000. So you could envision a system where you have financial privacy, and the government doesn't have visibility into all of these things, but you can still prove to the government that you've paid your taxes, you've done whatever was required. Similarly, it's not that Bitcoin is somehow unmonitored. You know, as I mentioned, especially with Bitcoin exchanges, we see all of the exchanges where you buy and sell Bitcoin are very heavily monitored for what your name is, who you are, how much Bitcoin you're buying and selling, and all of that information definitely goes back to the government, in part to help prevent terrorist financing and to help prevent these kinds of issues. Yeah, and you know, that's something which exists. You can also buy and sell Bitcoin locally, and governments try to monitor that, and that's fine, whatever. But we as a society have to kind of evaluate the trust that we're placing in financial institutions as to whether or not they should be able to just take this information and give it to the government without any kind of court order, or whether the government still has to come to you with an order and say, like, okay, give me your information, and then you can go about it as you would any kind of previous system that is a physical record book or something like that, just like people have had to do for decades. And so lastly, I want to talk briefly about financial inclusion. There's, you know, a lot of people who love to tout Bitcoin as a system for financial inclusion, for people who are, you know, can't get a bank account for whatever reason. Maybe they're in the third world and there's not a bank they like, or maybe they're an immigrant and they don't have the right kinds of ID or whatever. And it's true that Bitcoin solves some of these problems, kind of, but most of them not so much. There's a ton of issues with financial inclusion, with making sure everyone has access to banks that aren't just censorship, that are, you know, just general inclusion issues. And Bitcoin doesn't solve many of them, but it can help a lot. So the lack of kind of counterparty trust, where you always have to trust the parties you're dealing with. So with banks, largely the bank is in part trusting you, right? When you open a bank account, for whatever reason, the bank has to trust that you aren't going to go and do a bunch of fraud on their system, which has a ton of cost for them, and it makes all of their other users, it like hurts all of their other users in the system, and then they're kind of responsible for a lot of that fraud. So the bank is kind of forced to trust you. Luckily with Bitcoin, again, we're building the system that you shouldn't have to trust anyone else. And as long as you have the system where you don't have to trust your counterparty, all of a sudden, this issue where banks might not trust users and thus not give them accounts can go away. Further, it can provide increase in competition in this kind of space. Because the way the financial system is structured, banks are kind of also all trusting each other, and they're all trusting all of the other banks that they peer with within this kind of big mesh network that forms banking relationships. But this decentralization of lack of needing a trust can provide increase in competition, because all of a sudden, to become a bank, you don't have to get all of the other banks that you want to peer with to trust you. You can just exchange in Bitcoin, and there's no trust relationship needed there. That's less of an issue in the Western world, but it's certainly an issue in much of the developing world, and it's especially an issue when you're looking at trying to do remittances or crossing borders in the developing world. Right, as I mentioned earlier, you know, Western Union decided they couldn't deal with Syria anymore. It was kind of too much of a pain in the ass for them. It was too expensive for them to deal with. And so you have Bitcoin, where instead of having to trust all kinds of random people in Syria and try to get like a bank account with Deutsche Bank to be able to move money in and out of Syria in Europe, and like Deutsche Bank doesn't like that because it's creating a bunch of fraud, they can just say, no, we only deal with Bitcoin here coming in and out, and then we can just deal with the local currency, exchange it to Bitcoin, and then Bitcoin is our way out. Which kind of removes one half of that whole trust equation and makes it a whole lot simpler, hopefully providing a bit of an increase in competition. There's a lot of complications with using Bitcoin for some of these purposes, and thus you see some of this exists, some of it hasn't done so well, some of it has done pretty well, but it is an interesting thing to consider. Again, you know, that is something which applies kind of more to the developing world than the developed world. Certainly here in Europe, in the US, we don't really have too many issues with not having enough banks or too many people having, at least in Europe, it's a whole lot better, much better financial inclusion. In the US, we still have problems with people getting bank accounts, but Bitcoin doesn't solve many of those issues. So what does this mean for Bitcoin? So I'm going to talk maybe a bit more briefly about kind of my wheelhouse, the Bitcoin technical space, instead of just talking about social issues. So guys, as I discussed kind of earlier, early in the talk, Bitcoin has many different use cases. And each of these use cases has some different group that you're trying to avoid trusting. Maybe it's multiple groups you don't want to trust, but even still, each of these use cases often has people you're perfectly willing to trust. You know, I use Bitcoin because I care about many of the financial inclusion and financial censorship issues. That doesn't mean I don't trust the Fed or the ECB or regulators. In fact, I think regulation is important in most cases, just a question of how to have appropriate regulation and how to set up the incentives so that governments are forced to take regulation at an appropriate level instead of being able to kind of run wild with it. So the question kind of, how do we build technology around Bitcoin? I think the answer, a lot of it, tends to be we need to build systems where you can opt into trust relationships where they make sense, have reduced trust where it makes sense, and have full trustlessness, really don't trust anyone, only if you actually need it, because most users of Bitcoin don't care. And so we have a lot of kind of systems to do this. Bitcoin happens to be really cool in that it has this kind of programmable system for its transactions. I don't remember how much was talked about in the previous Dot and Gotten about Bitcoin, but transactions in Bitcoin, they're not spent to a public key, they're spent to a program. And the way you spend a transaction is you point to the previous output that's in the UTXO set, that's in the blockchain, and you say, I'm spending that, and here are the inputs to the program that you can run, and when you run the program, it validates the inputs, and then it says, yes, okay, you can spend this money. Now, of course, by default, the normal program that you run is just, please validate a signature, here's the public key, and then you provide the signature, and it runs and says, okay, great, you can spend this money. But you can do a whole lot of more interesting things. There are some pretty basic, but it turns out pretty powerful primitives in Bitcoin based on this. So obviously you can do multi-sig, you can do multiple signatures to spend money. In fact, this happens to be relatively unique in the entire financial world. How many banks are it where in order to spend money, you have to swipe two different credit cards back to back that two different people have so that it's two of two to spend money and not one of one? That's actually pretty cool. And a pretty simple thing to do in Bitcoin that a lot of people do already, especially between servers. They might have two different servers so that they don't trust that just one of their servers gets popped and they lose all their money. All of a sudden, you can have two different servers that are running different stacks and maybe only one of them will get popped. Similarly, we have things where you can lock a transaction for a certain period of time. So you can say, this transaction is not spendable for a week or a day or a month or a year, and it can only be spent after that time period. And we also have a primitive where you could say you can only spend this transaction with maybe the signature, but also you have to provide the pre-image to this hash. And those two together, this hash pre-image primitive and the time lock primitive, turn out to be super powerful in that you can build all kinds of really awesome systems where you can exchange transactions back and forth that are valid transactions that could be put on the blockchain in a week or in a day or in a month, but they're not valid transactions now. But because you have this transaction that you've received from that other person, and because of the way you can construct them where the other person can't unilaterally override that transaction, this transaction is as good as a payment to you. It's not in the blockchain, but whatever. It's a piece of data that you can, at some point in the future, put in the blockchain, and then you will be able to have that money. And interestingly, in a system like this, you could update this transaction. So you can send transactions back and forth between people and just keep updating it and keep a flying, floating balance between you and never touch the blockchain, but always have this transaction, which at some point, you know, when you've exchanged a transaction or updated the transaction, you always have this thing that you can put in the blockchain and get your money for it. And this has a slightly reduced security model from Bitcoin. It's very similar because you have this thing you can put in the blockchain, but you are trusting miners slightly more because there's some time limit. Because of the way it has to be constructed, there's always a time limit where if you don't get it into the blockchain by that time, then you lose the money. So it's a slightly worse trust model. Excuse me. Because you're trusting that miners won't somehow be evil for that period of time, or there won't be a big 51% attack against you for that period of time, or that you'll be able to get it into the blockchain for that period of time. But it's a super powerful primitive, and it's a super powerful system where you can transact back and forth endlessly without needing to touch the blockchain. And so this is just one example of how users might decide to slightly reduce their trust model from this full Bitcoin trustlessness, don't trust anyone ever, to maybe it's okay that we trust that I'll be able to get a transaction into the blockchain at some point in the next few days, and can build super powerful primitives. Similarly, I mean, the way people use Bitcoin today, a lot of people use Bitcoin by going on Coinbase and creating an account and buying some Bitcoin. They give them their credit card and they get some Bitcoin. But it's still just kind of a database entry in Coinbase, no different from any other bank. But that's perfectly fine for many users. Many users who want to buy Bitcoin, maybe they're interested in Bitcoin as a hedge against the dollar blowing up, or the Venezuelan bolivar blowing up, or the Chinese yuan not having as much value in the international currency markets next week. So they can choose to use a centralized system. And if you want to interact and transact within that centralized system, it works perfectly well. It's still backed by Bitcoin. It is still Bitcoin. And these users are still getting the thing they wanted out of Bitcoin. They're still being able to not have to trust someone else who might inflate their money, or maybe their money they don't trust for whatever reason. But it's still Bitcoin. And there's just a few examples of this kind of idea that Bitcoin, you can slightly relax this trust model, and use Bitcoin in super awesome ways that have way better features and way better user experience than Bitcoin, the on-chain Bitcoin, but still get the thing that you want out of it. Right, so I have time for this. So I'm going to briefly take a diversion. The previous talk about Bitcoin here at Dot and Gotten discussed some of the environmental impacts of Bitcoin mining. And so I wanted to briefly discuss that in maybe a bit more detail, because there was some, there's much more complexity to international power markets than was discussed. So Bitcoin mining, right, is designed to be highly competitive. It is this massively competitive thing where you have some power cost, you have some hardware, you spend a bunch of power on mining, and you get back some fixed-ish rate of Bitcoin based on the input of power that you spent. And so as a result, at the limit, hopefully, if Bitcoin continues to grow, the only way you're ever going to make money as a miner is to have the cheapest power. And to have kind of within some margin of error, the cheapest power of every other miner. Because if you spend a bunch of money on power, you're just going to lose money because you're not going to get back enough Bitcoin to cover your power costs. And we already see this today. In much of the world, it's not, you can't actually mine Bitcoin profitably. So Western power markets turn out to be a highly efficient market. They're not some kind of, you know, as a regular consumer, you go and you buy power and, like, you know, they bring power to your house and you pay a fixed rate per kilowatt, whatever. And that's just kind of what it is. Turns out that's not what's going on under the hood. There's like an actual market where people are bidding and asking on buying power in futures that are actually deliverable, right? You look at where Amazon's built some of its data centers in Washington State in the US, or and kind of the Oregon-Washington border in the US. They put their data center there, not even because that's actually where the power is coming from, but because that's actually where there is a spot market for power. They can bid on power futures, which are deliverable literally across the street from their data center. And so they do that to get access to a really efficient market on power. And you have to remember, you know, power is super expensive to transport, mostly. I mean, you lose a large amount of power if you transport it over long distances. And so as a result, you have, because these markets are pretty efficient, you kind of have the power of the thing that's closest to you is what you're going to pay for and what you're going to use. So if you're right next to a giant dam that's in the middle of nowhere, yeah, they can pipe that power to large cities, but doing so would waste a ton of money on, they'd waste a ton of power just trying to pipe it there. And so to some extent, they largely don't. And instead, you have steel smelters and data centers and whatever right next to those dams in the middle of central Washington state in the US where power is really cheap, because that power would otherwise often go unused. And thus you see kind of all of the mining in the Western world is in kind of Washington state and Iceland and a few other places where it's all hydro and geothermal, often in the middle of nowhere, at least not near large cities, because A, hydro and geothermal turn out to be the cheapest power in the Western world by far. And so if you want cheap power and you really have to have the cheapest power, you're going to put it by hydro or geothermal. And also because a lot of this power would otherwise either go unused or at least you'd get like a 30% haircut just trying to transport it somewhere else. Lastly, power supply, especially in the Western world where we have really reliable power, the supply is super static. People kind of underestimate how quickly you can turn on and off a coal plant or a nuclear plant or anything else. In fact, just about the only type of power you can turn on and off, like you can turn the station up or down, is nuclear, is natural gas and hydro. So solar, obviously you can't turn that on and off. You can't turn wind on and off. Coal plants and nuclear plants, you can't turn them up and down. It takes like a day or two or a week to turn it up and down. And so as a result, you have a lot of situations where you just have excess power because you can't turn the supply down very quickly. Some places, the way they solve this is they just don't generate quite enough on the normal power, and then they have what's called peakers, which are generally natural gas-based generators, which they kind of generate this the rest of the power. But in a lot of places, they just often have an excess of power. And if you have an excess of power, the only thing you can do with it is drive it to ground. And so you see on these spot markets for power, the power, if you're willing to spend $1 million on transformer and take like 14,000 volt power, is often negatively priced. It's very common in some power markets for power to actually be negatively priced. They'll pay you to take the power because they have to generate it and they can't do anything else with it. And so we haven't seen a ton of this in Bitcoin yet because it means you have to have hardware that is actually stable and you can turn it off and on every day and like run it at night when people's AC isn't running. But that is something which a lot of people are more excited about as the hardware kind of becomes a constant and it's not just like you buy hardware and it's out of date in 6 months. So if you haven't been running it the whole time, you've wasted your money. But that's something that people are talking more and more about, and I hope to continue to see more interest in, because I think that's something that's going to come in the Western world. Now, that's all about the Western market. If you know anything about Chinese Bitcoin mining, it's that they happen to be the world leader in Bitcoin mining by a pretty decent margin. And the Chinese power markets are way less mature, right? So in the Western world, we have these great spot markets, and power even goes negative. That's not really true at all in China. The grid is way less mature, so you have, this like it's expensive to transport power, but guess what? They don't even have the capacity to transport power. And so you have a lot of like random isolated dams or random isolated coal plants where the power is just like being generated and not really even used because no one can use it. So there is some Bitcoin mining that's done in China off coal, but even coal is more expensive in China than hydro, at least at a medium scale. Coal is much cheaper in China because they don't have environmental regulations, because those kind of get in the way of cost, you know. Even in China, you see a bunch of Bitcoin miners who are on like a 1 megawatt or a 2 megawatt hydro dam in kind of near Nepal, because there's a bunch of hydro there, but there's not enough kind of cabling to go hook up these medium to small dams that are kind of just sitting there. They might have been built for a factory that shut down, or they were built for whatever reason, and they're just kind of halfway unused or mostly unused. And so you see a lot of miners using that. You do see some miners who are hooked up to coal plants that are similarly unused, but that's often because that's more expensive. Funnily enough, you see that more during winter when some of the water is not running in near Nepal. but that is a bit more expensive. And lastly, you do see some stolen power. We've seen some arrests in that space. So that's probably less than it used to be. But occasionally people can, you know, find somewhere where they can do a backroom deal and get power for free off the grid. And then they go to jail. So, yeah, so that's all I had prepared to talk about. But I would love to take lots of questions because hopefully that was interesting in some way.
Test? Yeah.
Yeah, so thanks for the talk. It was really enlightening in many aspects, especially the economical aspects. But I'd like to challenge another assumption that the Princeton Bitcoin is modded to not trust anyone. I know that this is ideal, and maybe Bitcoin gets it better than most other systems, but still, I believe to own Bitcoin, you do not have to take over 51% of the network. I believe most miners simply do what their, let's say, their group leaders do. And most group leaders, maybe they discuss, but they, in the end, the software developer community is have much more influence than most of them. So it's mostly, let's say, the leaders of the Bitcoin of the miners and the software developers.
Yeah, to some extent, it's definitely the case that kind of Bitcoin's trustlessness is very much an ideal and something to be strived for, which has at times been clearly not true, and I think it's becoming more true as we move forward. I think it is absolutely the case that there are a lot of community members who are definitely trusted much more than others. And I mean, you mentioned that it's a small group of people that miners might follow. Well, I mean, that's kind of their pools. And there is a small group of people who represent 51% of hash power based on pools. I think it is true that, so there's kind of two things you brought up. You said trust miners and also software developers. I think there's kind of, so first of all, I'm going to respond to kind of the software developer one. So it is true that there are, you know, a lot of software developers who work on Bitcoin. You know, I'm one of them. I spend most of my time working on low-level Bitcoin protocol plumbing stuff. And there's a lot of people who say, like, okay, well, we're kind of having to trust the software developers. And you have to trust the software developers if you can't audit the code base, certainly. I mean, obviously, you're trusting the code base that you're running. But in terms of the software developers being able to kind of make changes to the system, especially make changes to the system where you would lose Bitcoin that you thought you owned, or where you would be kind of censored or prevented from using the system in the future, or something like that, I really don't think that is something that is realistic to ever be kind of pushed onto the community, just because it is a very clear social value of the community that this should not ever happen. And specifically, any forks in Bitcoin, whether it's a soft fork or a hard fork or whatever, any changes to the system do have to actually be adopted by the system's members. Certainly, it's the case that a mining majority could enforce changes to the system on a temporary basis. They can do censorship attacks where they have 51% hash power and attack and prevent certain transactions from making it to the blockchain. But because of the way hash power works, if you have the resources, you can buy hash power and buy out 51% and kind of take back Bitcoin. And you know, I mean, that's kind of a weird thing to say, like, oh, you just spend $1 million and you take back Bitcoin. But as it turns out, there's actually like a lot of people who have money invested in Bitcoin, who have the resources to do that, and by no question would absolutely do that. There's a lot of people I talk to who, you know, are very, very interested in throwing $1 million or $10 million at hash power just to increase the decentralization and the security of Bitcoin's hash power. but largely haven't been able to do so because they can't find someone to run it, and they don't know how to run hash power, and they don't really want to deal with that. But I mean, if there was a problem, wow, they would buy hash power tomorrow, like no question. And so I think because Bitcoin has these kind of social values where the community is very strongly against censorship and very strongly against these kinds of attacks on whatever transaction, you know, attacks on taking people's Bitcoin effectively. And because the community has to effectively enforce any changes that you want to have to the system, at least in order for them to be staying changes, you can temporarily do it with hash power, but for them to be staying, the community at large has to enforce them. I think it's very unrealistic to say that developers or a small group of community members could effectively take someone's Bitcoin through a censorship attack of their transactions. And I guess I kind of, to some extent, answered the second part of the question with hash power, just because it is definitely the case that there are a lot of people who are very happy to buy hash power to kind of attack someone who's attacking the system, for better or for worse. I hope that answered the question.
Have any more questions? Here in the front.
Thanks for the talk. Great talk. Unfortunately, it's a pity that we hardly have these kind of talks about Bitcoin at CCC, so I'm actually not having a question. I want to highlight a hint that you made. I imagine having been sitting on a chaos congress 10 years ago and predicted that in 10 years we will have decentralized digital cash, everybody would have gone like, yeah, possible. But if I would have said, but in 10 years time, Edeka is going to accept it for my grocery shopping, but Chaos Communication Club is not going to accept it for a Congress ticket, everybody would have gone like, oh, no, go away, that's stupid, why would that happen? But unfortunately it is like that. And since there seem to be a lot of people now here in the room who are CCC people, I would like to ask you to maybe start a discussion inside CCC why this is the case, because I believe the Bitcoin community and the CCC community have a lot to give each other, and it's really a pity looking at it and seeing like this is not really happening. Just all I wanted to say.
Thanks, I tend to agree.
Like this gentleman cannot pay his ticket via Bitcoin, like Matt cannot pay a ticket from the United States with Bitcoin. It's like a 30% plus that you a surplus that you have to pay when you don't want to use, I don't know, when you cannot use German bank accounts or anything. Anyway, thanks.
Yeah, I think the 30% up is for credit cards.
Yeah, it's for credit cards.
So not this. There's just no possibility to pay with Bitcoin. It's not an additional fee. This would be outraging. Do we have other questions?
You talked about activists or like positive things. Could you predict what might happen in the future if the big corporations discover Bitcoin and all this stuff? I'm not too much into finance, but all this high speed trading and everything that is happening at the Wall Street, could you say what might be, how Bitcoin might be misused by these people? Because as you said, mining is quite much about computing power, and obviously these are the people who have the money to put quite a lot of effort into misusing the system.
I mean, in terms of kind of banks misusing Bitcoin, by hash power attack, like by buying more hash power and then doing some attacks on the system so that maybe it's unusable. I think that's possible. We already have an actually pretty impressive amount of hash power in terms of just the wattage that's going into running Bitcoin. And as it turns out, there's not a ton of cheap power lying around in the world, at least in the Western world anymore. There's some to be had from a lot of the interruptible power stuff, but like Iceland's grid tends to run in the like 90% utilization range because there's a bunch of steel and data centers and Bitcoin miners. Well, there used to be Bitcoin miners there. It's entirely possible that large corporations decide they're just going to attack and destroy Bitcoin or that a government entity does that. I find it marginally unlikely. Obviously, if you're getting into Bitcoin mining, you have to buy very specialized hardware that's designed for Bitcoin mining. If it were the case that someone showed up and attacked Bitcoin and destroyed it by a hash power attack, we can change the proof of work algorithm. No one wants to change that algorithm, but we could decide like, oh, well, Bitcoin has been completely destroyed. Let's just change this algorithm and all of their hardware investment that they made, is now worthless. And now we continue to use the system and they just got burned buying millions of dollars in hardware that is now useless. I don't envision that being a serious issue. Also because, you know, I talk to folks on Wall Street and a bunch of them don't care about Bitcoin, but a bunch of them see it as a cool technology and a cool hedge and a cool thing that they can incorporate in their business. You know, there's a lot of what I talked about was like Bitcoin increasing competition in these markets by removing the need for trust, but also adding trust back makes for a much more usable and much better UX system. And certainly a lot of what I work on is trying to make sure that it's not so much more usable that people never use the trustless Bitcoin or that people can't use the trustless Bitcoin because it's unusable, but like the centralized go through a bank Bitcoin is usable. But it's always going to be more usable to go have Bitcoin through a Coinbase or a bank or whatever. And there's nothing preventing any of these institutions from, you know, a bunch of them are excited about hedging some small amount in Bitcoin, but also providing Bitcoin services. And that's not really, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners hate that idea, but that's a pretty decent business opportunity for a lot of these companies. So I think someone else already has the mic.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you for your speech. That was really interesting. I have two questions, and the first is you spoke about like social inclusion and that there are a lot of obstacles on this way, and maybe you can describe some obstacles on the way. That would be interesting. And the second question is a little bit more far away, like for cases of sustainable development or an issue of sustainable development, the mining thing, could it be that because you need additional power and if like power lags are used enough, like you described, that this could be an issue on sustainable development when additional power have to be created in any way or renewable or fossil energy to mine the Bitcoin system?
Yeah, so as for your first question, which was about financial inclusion. There's a lot of different issues. A lot of people look at the developing world where, you know, there's a lot of people who like don't have an ID. You can't open a bank account with most banks if you don't even have an ID. That turns out to also be an issue in the US. There's a lot of people, whether they're in the US without a visa or whether they're in the US and just have never bothered to get an ID, they've never needed an ID, especially in a lot of poorer communities in the US. Don't have an ID. Equally, in a lot of poorer communities in the US, there's a somewhat understandable distrust for banks and people just don't want to have a bank account, but it also,
I meant for the case of the barrier for buying Bitcoins and do the transactions with it. So you said that, if I got it wrong, right, you said that used to use Bitcoins, there are a lot of obstacles to do that, right? You speak about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, so I mean, it's just because of Bitcoin's relative immaturity, right? Bitcoin is still a pretty new system. There's still to get Bitcoin online, you have to jump through a lot of hoops to, you know, take a picture of your passport and get a picture of your, get a scan of your utility bill and send them to an exchange, and the exchange validates it, and then you can get an account, and there's limits on your account, and that's kind of a pain. Or you could go meet someone in the corner of a coffee shop, and they might stab you and take your money, or you might get Bitcoin, and usually you get Bitcoin, but you never know. And so, I mean, there's still, it's just because it's kind of a relatively new system, there's still, you often have to do, you know, even these exchanges that have lots of KYC, some of them turn out to be sketchy, some of them are fine and are now finally being good businesses. Many of them historically have been complete shit. And some of them still are. And so it's just kind of the relative newness of the system. People are that, plus people are uncomfortable with, you know, getting a wallet. Like, you have to have a wallet app on your phone or on your computer, and you have to secure your phone or your computer because someone can take your money if they hack you all of a sudden, which is a whole new area of cybersecurity that a lot of us, you know, we target people pop a server farm or something, not people pop mom and dad and take all of their money because it was on their computer. So yeah, I mean, it's just because Bitcoin is new and there's challenges to be worked on here, a lot of challenges to be worked on here. And I think you're gonna have to remind me of your second question, I apologize.
Just because of the energy thing with mining, so my question is, if so at the moment you say that mining is a good alternative to use less energy, or which is maybe wasted or not generated. However, like if that is used with mining, and the mining community is growing, so there's more demand on energy. And the question is, if like Bitcoin is in the future maybe a good alternative or a good addition to the current financial system. So if you see like a certainty to unsustainable development because more energy have to be created for mining.
So I mean, there's two parts of that, right? So there's the part of using interruptible power, which is the power that is otherwise going to go unused. And certainly there, right, your goal is, there are a lot of utilities in the world where you can go to the utility and the utility will give you sometimes 6 hours notice, sometimes 1 hour notice, and tell you like, okay, you can use power now, or okay, you can't use power now because they have excess or they don't. So certainly if you're doing interruptible power, that doesn't really have a strong impact on their need to roll out extra capacity to handle you, because they get to decide and tell you exactly on the hour, and you know, hopefully as some of this stuff matures on the minute, and say like, okay, we have extra power now, go ahead and use it, or no, we don't, stop. And so that shouldn't impact their need to roll out more power. On the flip side, of course, you know, there is some base load that Bitcoin is going to have drawing from dams or whatever else. Yeah, I mean, it is the case that Bitcoin uses power, and that power won't be used for other purposes. You know, as I talked about in China, a lot of people are there are a number of Bitcoin farms that are kind of on dams that, sure, that dam could be connected to the grid. The Chinese grid is relatively immature, so none of these dams are, because, you know, they're kind of in the middle of nowhere, and connecting a 2 megawatt dam in the middle of nowhere to a grid so that it can serve a city 1,000 kilometers away doesn't really make financial sense. There's kind of no reason to do it. So that's a part of it. It's arguable whether you could say that, you know, more mining in Washington State, which is kind of, you know, if you know anything about the geography of Washington State, you have like Seattle on the western side and then kind of nothing anywhere else in the state. And there's a bunch of dams and a bunch of really, really big, actually a lot of power capacity kind of in the middle of the state. And historically, that has been used for various industrial applications, whether you're doing steel smelting or carbon fiber manufacturing or whatever, things that use a lot of power. Now, of course, there's a bunch of data centers there. There's Amazon's big. But I think the kind of property I mentioned briefly is to make it so that there is less cost to not using those, and so that, you know, people who need it, which, you know, I wouldn't say are our enemies more than our friends. I would say it includes people like Cage, who are standing up and saying CIA black sites are fucked up and we need to get people out of Guantanamo. We're helping people like that. And we're helping people who often can't get a bank account for purely political reasons that has nothing to do with any actual illegal activity. There was a case in the US where the Department of Justice went around to a lot of banks and said, oh, this person, yeah, they're a porn actress. You don't want to do business with them. And then they couldn't get a bank account. Or this person, they did it to a number of people. It was largely focused on what's called the payday lending, loan industry in the US, which are generally really scammy, seedy people. But it also caught a bunch of people in the net that really should not have been caught by it. Porn actresses, gun shop owners, whatever you think of guns in the US, they're illegal and they get to have bank accounts. And so I think the issue of thinking in this kind of like, well, are we helping our enemies more than our friends? Well, guess what? If we remove internet surveillance, maybe we're helping our enemies more than our friends. Or if we remove surveillance on phone numbers that we have now and on phone calls, we might be helping our enemies more than our friends. But we have to decide, is it worth it as a society to say, fuck your privacy, or screw you, we're going to have individuals at the NSA who get access to your phone calls and your internet chats or whatever, just so that we can maybe happen to catch some terrorists and could otherwise do that in other ways. And right, it's not like the government is not going to be able to look at what people are doing and set up monitoring and do all of these things that they've traditionally been very good at doing. It just slightly increases the cost of doing so. And by increasing the cost, it makes it so that all of a sudden they can't do dragnet surveillance and they can't do dragnet financial censorship or surveillance. They have to actually target individuals and they have to actually make decisions and say, who are we going to target, so that it's not something where they just catch a bunch of random people who probably they aren't doing anything illegal and maybe shouldn't be targeted. So I don't know, I was kind of rambling, but...
Hi. I have a quite practical question. I just paid 25 cents as a fee on a €1.50 payment here. So, I mean, it's going up and up. 2 years ago, it was like a tenth of that, and before that, it was even lower. Do you think that's a normal state we need to get used to, and it might even get more expensive, or do you think it will reverse? And, yeah, what is your opinion on that?
Yeah, so there's two answers to this. The first answer is yes, and the second answer is no. So, first of all, yes. Look, the way Bitcoin is designed, it is the actual blockchain Bitcoin, it's a fucking broadcast network. Everyone in the network sees every transaction that hits the blockchain, validates it, and stores it. And they relay it onto their peers. That's like super expensive to run, that's super expensive to validate, and there's a lot of limits that we have to reasonably place on that so that people are able to continue to use it. Further, whether you agree with it from a technical perspective or not, there is a 21 million coin cap in Bitcoin, and over time, miners are paid less and less, and if they're not paid in fees, then that security of that system kind of goes away. And so, you know, we can have a discussion about whether fees are necessarily needed in the system right now, but in the long term, fees are going to be needed, and they're going to be there, and they're going to be significant. That said, that doesn't mean you have to pay fees on the transactions that you're doing. A Bitcoin transaction doesn't have to always hit the chain, right? Like I was talking about earlier, there's systems that we can design where you can create transactions and you never pay the fee on it until it eventually hits the blockchain and you just keep creating them. Or if you're willing to opt into a centralized trust system because there's other parts of Bitcoin you care about, you can go use a bank that transacts in Bitcoin, whether it's Coinbase or an actual bank. And you, of course, don't have to pay fees on that because they're just updating database entries. And so, you know, long term, there will be fees in Bitcoin. That's something that has to exist. But hopefully there will maybe not be so many fees on transactions that users see, just the things in the blockchain.
Yeah, so I happen to be quite familiar with payment channels, so we use them, but even on-chain payments should, I think, be cheaper again. And in theory, you could run the Bitcoin network on 3 graphics cards, and this whole industry that's there could also shrink. I mean, it doesn't have to be so expensive as it is now. I mean, they started off with like Satoshi's computer and like 2 or 3 other guys, and it could shrink again to a size that's much cheaper, much more economical. So I think the miners should be prepared to kind of make less money.
Yeah, and on the flip side of that, it is certainly the case that the like limits we have today on the size of the chain, on the chain growth limits, are super restrictive. They were very appropriate based on technology that we had 2 years ago, because the technology we had 2 years ago was way worse than the technology we have today. A lot of us have spent a ton of time improving a lot of that stuff. And so it's completely not unreasonable to increase the limits we have on chain growth today and allow way more transactions, hopefully with lower fees. Equivalently, you know, we can have a discussion about what an appropriate payment for miners is. That's obviously a super hard thing to like, how much hash rate does the network need to be secure versus not secure? It's kind of, I mean, it's a hard discussion to have, but you can put actual numbers on it. I mean, you can sit down and say like, okay, well, if people are transacting on average €1 million worth of transactions every day, then the network should probably at least cost €1 million to attack the transactions of that day. And it turns out that that's actually a reasonably large amount of money in fees, just to provide that level of security. So, yes and no. I mean, it's complicated. Obviously, the issue really is that there are so many different parts of Bitcoin that people are excited about. You know, as I was talking about in the lecture, some people love Bitcoin because of the 21 million coins limit. Some people love it because of the fact that it's global. Some people love it because of the fact that they don't have to trust a bank. There's like so many different aspects, and many of those don't need all that much security. Maybe if you just care about it being global and you're not going to use it for very large values, you don't care. Other people really need that security. People who need to just care about the 21 million coins limit, well, just as kind of as long as the thing keeps running, and we're all enforcing the 21 million coins limit, not just miners, so yeah, whatever. And so it gets really tricky trying to change the system in any way and trying to have a discussion about kind of what the system should be long term, because people care about different parts of the system, and trying to design changes to the system which are not breaking some or not favoring some trust models over other trust models turns out to get really tricky. So I'm happy to chat more offline, but it's a hard question, I guess.
Okay, I think we don't have any more questions for now. So first, I would ask for another round of applause for this amazing talk. Second, I want to ask, will you be available for some more questions if something's coming up at the bar for some time?
Yeah, totally. I'll hang out at the bar for a while.
So if somebody has a question he or she didn't ask now and wants to ask, afterwards, he will hang around a little bit at the bar. Also, I would love to announce already the next Datengarten. This time we are early and already have the one prepared for next month, which will be about patterns which you can find on Facebook, which are used by the upcoming right, so AfD, for everybody who knows this from Germany. We'll discuss this. This will be a data analysis, how they behave and how they find followers and how they use social media to gain popularity. So, next month, same place, also the 14th again. We'll meet here again at 8 o'clock. Doors will open at 7, so you're welcome to come a little earlier if you want to. And that's it for today. Have a great night, and thanks again.